Welcome back to the podcast. We speak with Celine Pilch this show 136, and it's turned into a rather longer discussion potentially than I'd intended, but delightfully so. So this is going to be part one, and we focus really on Celine's biography and her influences and her artistic ideas and how they inform her pinhole and alternative work. Part two, I think, is going to be largely based around her work output and different ideas and imagery that she makes. There is a, towards the end of the recording, I lose her. I press something on the phone. But then we get her back and finish the show off for the last 15 minutes or so. So it'll be professionally edited in between. Anyway, enjoy part one, and I look forward to part two. Hello and welcome back to the Lensless Podcast. It's show 136. And I'm very pleased to be joined this time around, as I am with every single guest we have on this show, with Berlin-based artist, but I think maybe Paris-based artist at the moment, is Celine Pilch. Have I said your surname properly, Celine? Because we didn't check that before we started.
It's perfect.
Good. That's not a too complicated surname. Before we get chatting properly with Celine, I'd just like to thank John Farnan for coming on the show last time, despite the noises in the background that I think were down to my clicking the keyboard. I'll try and be a lot better and not touch anything while I'm talking to Celine. So there we are. Celine, welcome. And what's the weather like in Paris?
Hi, thank you for having me here. Well, the weather is like you want to stay in bed the whole day.
Sounds good. With a baguette, some melted camembert and a glass of red wine.
Exactly.
But you're not from Paris, are you? I did get confused at one point, because when I first mentioned to some of the folks on the Lenders Podcast Facebook group, I said, oh, I've got a Paris-based artist, and I was thinking that you lived permanently in Paris. I must have picked up somewhere that you're in Paris, but you're not. It's clearly with a title on Instagram like Obscura Berlin. You're not. You know, you're not living in Paris permanently.
No, I'm not living in Paris permanently. I'm frequently in Paris, but yeah, I kind of gave up stable life, so I'm not based anywhere at the moment. But if I'm somewhere for a longer time, it might be Paris or Berlin.
So you're nomadic at the moment.
I'm nomadic, yeah. Last year in November, so now it's 1 year, I left Berlin to travel to Jordan, Egypt, and Lebanon.
Wow, did you?
Yeah.
Well, I've seen that you've been in those areas, but I didn't know the story of why you were there.
Well, I just wanted to travel since a while, you know. Then there was the pandemic, so it was always not possible. And I started to learn Arabic 2.5 years ago. So this is why I chose to go to Arabic countries, because, yeah, if you really want to learn a language, you have to go to the country.
And especially one that doesn't speak a lot of English, I guess.
Yeah, well, they do, they do. But yeah, so I don't know, I was just curious. And also sometimes, you know, in the media in Europe, you have such a very bad image of Islamic culture and Islamic countries, so I felt like I need to have my own view on it. So I left, and yeah, while traveling, I already felt like I don't want to go back to my stable life. It's just so good to be traveling. And I managed to have photo projects, give workshops while traveling. So until now, it's working.
So has they been able to give workshops in different places? And I noticed, looking at some of the Instagram posts, in fact, if folks want to look at Celine's work, probably Instagram's the best place. It's Obscura_Berlin. And in there, you've got sort of screenshots of various exhibitions and little billboards saying pinhole workshops and things, and some Arabic, some things in, I can see one now, pinhole photography written on a blackboard with some
what looks like Arabic maybe underneath, but I'm no clearly no linguist. So has that helped to pay for your travels, or have you had to do what everyone does, bar work, or are you just a millionaire?
I'm just a millionaire.
Yes, what thought?
No, well, I've been doing Workaway, so this is a page where you can find jobs, and you stay in the place of the people. So I've been doing different jobs. You're not paid, but you don't have to pay for your rent. Sometimes you get
Oh.
food.
What's that called? Sorry.
Workaway.
This is amazing, isn't it? I learned so much. See.
Yeah, it's very, very nice because you just type any kind of country and then you find a place where you could go. And it's just like, okay, now
So
I will go there.
you normally get accommodation and or food, and it could be like a room in a cafe. So you're working there. You're not getting paid, but you're getting subsistence. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Sometimes you even get paid. It depends. But I was, like, for example, in the desert of Jordan, I was doing like housekeeping, taking care of the dogs. In Cairo, I was working as a bartender, but it was a guy who was doing parties, so I was living in his flat, like a shared flat. Yeah, but it's a lot of also agriculture and like au pair, also like taking care of children. And
And is it presumably it's well vetted for somebody traveling by themselves, no matter what sex they are, you can be vulnerable, can't you?
yeah, but it's a platform, you have to pay for it. Like, you pay 40 euros per year. So this is kind of like, it's not for free, so it's more safe, I feel, it's controlled. But and then you can also see what how other people yeah, experience the stay in a certain place. So I felt very secure. But
Good.
I'm also not very scared. That's also the thing, I'm like, okay, I just go. We will see.
Yeah, I think maybe if you go into new environments with the right mindset, that sort of translates into body language as well, and your demeanor, and you portray a sort of I'm supposed to be here kind of attitude with your whole body language and your conversations and and what you say to people.
Yeah, that's true, yeah.
And I think that can help make you safer as well.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, yeah, I mean, it said you kindly sent me your biography, which says here you speak German, French, English, Spanish, and Arabic. Wow. Okay. So has language has always been a thing for you? What is that something in your background, your parents, or how come you speak so many languages? Apart from
Yeah,
just being clever and not English.
yeah, it's my background. My mother was German and my father French. And so I grew up bilingual, and I grew up in Germany, but my father was always living in France, so my parents were not together. So I always had to travel to France to see my family in France, and my father is very French, so he just speaks French. No German, no English. So I learned French since a child, and this is also why I'm quite easy with other languages. Once you speak French, it's not so difficult to learn Spanish. And yeah, I think that's why. And I mean, speaking different languages also opens so many doors, no? When I was living a little bit in Spain and Argentina. And of course, it changes everything if you speak the language. And it was the same when I was in the Arabic countries. Now, like, they react so differently if you speak in their language with them. They are like so happy. So,
They wouldn't be expecting a white woman
yeah.
landing on their doorstep to suddenly be speaking in their language. I wouldn't have thought it wouldn't be that common.
Yeah, of course. And this is also funny because then you can have the situation that people would like tell other people, like, take care, she's speaking Arabic.
Yeah, because you can go into an environment and not let that be known, and
Yeah.
they could be saying all sorts of things about you, couldn't they? Brilliant. I love it. So tell us, give us a bit of your biography then. So you grew up with it in a bilingual situation, hopping between France and Germany. Was that movement between the cities, was that from a fairly early age? I don't know when your parents split up, but did you find yourself traveling from an early age?
I kind of never knew them together. So it was from the beginning on, and at the beginning it was train rides. I remember train rides during the night, you know, my mother bringing me to my father's place or the other way around. So I grew up in Bremen. It's a very small, well, it's not so small. It's a small city in the north of Germany. And then I moved to Berlin when I was 18. I wanted to go to the big city. And I've been doing a lot of stuff. I wanted to be a fashion designer, so I did an apprenticeship as a sewer, like to design clothes. And then I didn't feel so comfortable in the fashion business.
So that was in Berlin, wasn't it? I see here between for a couple of years in 2010 and 12. What
That was
drew you, sorry, what drew you to wanting to be a fashion designer? So, or in the world of fashion?
I really like clothes and to combine different things. And at that time, that was really my theme, you know. And I like to sew. I like to do handcraft anyway. I came up with that idea. But yeah, fashion business. I mean, I've been working a little bit on the Fashion Week in Paris and Berlin, and it's just not my world.
Is it
I'm not fancy enough.
a bit bitchy and cutthroat?
Of course, yes. I mean, not just like that, because you also have just normal people who love to do that kind of work. But of course, it's part of it. And I was scared of it, I think.
Yeah, I would be too.
Yeah, it's not my style, you know. I think there are people who love this kind of world with glitter and being very fancy. But me, no, not so much. So, yeah.
So what did
So,
you
yeah.
what were your key takeaways from your 2 years working for the fashion school or studying at the fashion school in Berlin? What you must have you, what were you, so you walked away from it, but what did you take away from it?
Well, I knew how to sew. I knew how to produce clothes.
That's handy when you're traveling the world on a budget, isn't it? You can just mend your clothes.
Of course. Yeah, it's always good to have handcraft knowledge, you know,
It is
wherever you
absolutely.
go. Yeah. And it's also a very accurate work. So we had to do drawings, for example, of the cloth we would produce, and that has to be so accurate because it was more in the idea of producing cloth, not just one piece. So it gave me also the knowledge of making very accurate drawings. Because our teacher was also very strict, and she was looking at the things, and then when it was not well done, she was like putting it with a red pen, and
I did an engineering apprenticeship, and I went straight from school at 16 down to London. I just can't imagine ever subjecting any of my kids when they were that age to this. But I went down to London, and I kind of left home at 16 into this environment with other lads in a training center, and we did a sort of crash course in engineering techniques. And one of them was, well, I think it was a very similar experience to you. It was meant to develop your hand-eye skills, your delicacy, your accuracy, and it comprised of filing with a hand file blocks of metal to within several thousandths of an inch, and then you would measure the corner, because if anyone's ever used a file, it's very easy to put too much pressure in one part of the hand tool, and you end up taking too much metal off in one corner. And so the instructor would come in with a thing called a micrometer, which is a very accurate measuring gauge, and he would move it around the block of wood of metal. And you were when you saw him turning it a lot, it looked like it was you filed like an inch of metal off, but really it's only like a few thousandths of an inch. And he would look at you, take this block of wood, and he would just throw it in the corner and tell you to start again. It was horrible, and all the instructors were there. I'm sure they were just they were there because they just weren't any good at working in the real world, I'm sure. But they just loved the power, and it was a different world, you know. And I have to say, I really hated it at first. Over the 5 years that I stuck at the engineering traineeship, it got better. But in those early days, you know, when you're very young and you're moving away from home for the first time, it's a huge learning curve at such a young age. But some of those teachers, oh dear me, goodness. Yeah. So it just reminded me when you said your lady, your strict Berlin lady.
It's the same style, I think.
With a red pen. No good, start again. Okay, so so from there, what happened after there? After you told her she could stick her red pen where the sun never shines.
Well, then I gave up the idea of fashion and I opened my own bar.
Did you?
Yeah. Okay. I had a bar when I was very young. I was 21. Okay. And
where was that? Where did you open that?
It was in Berlin. It was in Neukölln, which is like a little bit the Arabic quarter. Mm-hmm. So that was the wild years, you know, like Berlin is a party place. And at that time, I think it was even more still underground party place. Like there were clubs which were illegal. There were, you know, I mean, the bar we had was it was literally just a place where we put old furniture that we found in the street.
Fantastic. And I love it already.
I mean, we had a fridge, of course, but it was all improvised, you know. And I mean, at that time, it was still possible to say, like, I'm a 21-year-old girl just coming from my apprenticeship, and now I'm going to open a bar, which would be impossible today because no one would even rent you a place, you know. Like, but in that time in Berlin, it was still this vibe of empty places, things that could happen, you know, like, which is kind of over now. If you want to rent a bar in Berlin now, it's going to be so expensive and very difficult to start something.
A lot of these places that you're referring to presumably was what's on what we would know as the old eastern side of Berlin, which presumably, is that right?
Well, it was in the western side.
Was it? Okay.
Yeah, right. But I mean, I know what you mean, but because it was especially in the eastern sides that were, you had empty places. But in that quarter where I had my bar, it was still also, not far away from the city center, but still kind of abandoned, you know, like when I moved to Berlin, people were even telling me, are you sure you want to live in that quarter? It's kind of dangerous. And now it's like the most fanciest place in Berlin. You know, it still has its dirty places, but
it's... How were your Arabic skills back then? Were they non-existent or were you just...
non-existent. But there has always been this attraction to the Arabic world, you know?
So. Yeah. Has that influenced you, do you think? I mean, you are clearly... otherwise you wouldn't be on this show, a very visual and artistic person. And we'll come on to the specifics of that eventually, but this is just so interesting. So, you know, you went to the fashion school, you're running a bar. How is all that tying in with your creative side? What's going on in your creative world other than being creative enough to open a bar?
Well, opening a bar was very creative in the way that it was really an empty room. It was not a bar before, so we had to install it all. So it was like my playground, you know, like we painted the walls in black. We had a room which was just for UV lights. So you can just develop whatever you want and say, well, yeah, let's do that. That's a good idea.
It sounds like Rock City in Nottingham in the in the late 1980s. Did you have sticky floors as well?
No. Well, at the end of the night. So it was, and then the something I was doing at that time too, I have always been kind of very analog because I like to feel things through in my hands, you know, and I like to be able to manipulate the things on my own, not to depend on, you know, the computer. And so we were doing events.
We're not related by any chance, are we?
You're like this too.
Yeah, go on, carry on.
Yeah. So we were doing events, you know, and at that time you're always already using Facebook to promote our parties, and instead of creating like banners or flyers on InDesign, I was doing it by hand. I was doing little collage in the size of the banner. So at a certain point, I knew what size it had to have in real life to then scan it and then put it on our Facebook event. So I could spend hours and days to create these little flyers with different layers of things I cut out from somewhere to then scan it. And I mean, the result is just a Facebook event, but I still have these little objects, you know? So I kind of found always a way to, yeah, to have my creativity and to give it a sense, you know? I think that's really important for me if what I do can have a place and be useful instead of just producing and then it's there and in a box and no one will look at it.
Yeah, and I think that's a common problem for photographers in general. I mean, I spend a lot of time on social media, not so much on Twitter these days, but mostly I'm on Blue Sky when it comes to Twitter-like things, and in the Facebook groups, and also when I meet up with fellow photographers, analog folk. You know, what do you do? What's the point of it all? Well, you know, that's a very deep and difficult question, but
Yeah.
and f folks can find, I think you just have to come to your own sense of peace with whatever art you're pursuing. And if it's just for you and your family, well, that's more than okay, because that's satisfying a need, isn't it?
Of course, yeah.
But other folks might want to make little zines, and they can be basic handmade things, and that gives them a focus. It could be, you know, making a box set of prints. It could be making a book. It could be just things for the wall. It could be things for exhibitions. And then, you know, and of course, maybe you want to change the world.
Of course, we all want, no? No, yeah, but of course, I mean, I think everyone has to find his own sense behind that. But I think we are all satisfied if things have a place. Like I would call it like this: if it's on the wall, if it's yeah, on your Facebook page, or if it's wherever. But if you introduce your pieces of art, of work into this world, and you can share it with other people. And if it's just your neighbor or your sister or whatever, it doesn't have to be 1,000 people, but yeah, I think then the things can develop their own life also, no? Like
Yeah, I like I buy the Ilford paper, quite thick paper, but it's the size of postcards. It used to be sold as postcard paper, you
yeah.
know, and then I go in the dark room and I make prints, and I send them to people, and I don't put them in envelopes. I just put a stamp on them and write a note on them with their address and send them around the world. But they're hand made little postcards, and quite a few folks do this now. But I've been doing it for 10, 15 years or so.
Oh, that's very nice.
And I like the idea, because it's a very old-fashioned thing, isn't it? Sending postcards. I mean, who sends postcards? You know, I like the idea of it passing through lots of different people's hands. You know, so the Royal Mail postman in the sorting office, if they still have such things, probably old. I'm just envisaging a person looking at it. You know, and why wouldn't they? If it was me, I'd read the back and say, "Well, what's this?" You know. They probably don't, but
Yeah.
I just love the idea of, and then it goes, the most recent one has gone off to the States, and before that it went to the Netherlands, and I just love the idea of these things getting slowly degraded. I'm not interested in whether it's a perfect image turning up. If it's bent and got someone's got a bit wet, well, that's because it's done its job as a postcard. It's lived its life, and then it's going to arrive at someone's house, and they can get a bit of pleasure from it, and it can either go on the fridge for a little while and then gradually fade and go in the bin, or it might just stay up on the wall forever, you know.
Yeah, that's nice.
So that was a sidetrack, by the way, but it's all to do with, isn't it, about what we do with our art, how we communicate, what, you know, what purpose there is for things.
Yeah. And I mean, in the world of art, for me, it's anyway also very interesting to see how differently everyone is treating his work and his art and the purpose. Like, I've been working a lot with workshops, and I always love to to observe how people are treating materials, how people are approaching the work, you know, like everyone has a specialty, I would say. Like, then you have people who are more like engineers. They are so much into the technical side of things, and they might be very critical and very concrete. And then you have people who are like completely chaotic, and you know, and this is also the way you treat then your products or the things you do in the world, how you treat them, where you bring them, how you, yeah, conserve them.
So I saw looking on your, we've jumped out of your biography in a moment, but we'll come back to it. But while you're talking about workshops, I'm just here looking at your sort of CV biography thing. And so earlier this year, pinhole photography for beginners in Jordan. So, and
Yeah.
then textile and vegetable printing just before that in Cairo and Egypt. So this is obviously when you're doing your traveling around. In that area, and then pinhole in August, pinhole and cyanotype, and oh, back in Berlin, there you go. So that's for school for young people, and
Yeah.
then in Cairo, 2 day workshop with young refugees. That's interesting. We'll come on. And then working with self-made cameras. So tell us a bit about that period of time when you were delivering those workshops this year, and what led you to those, what you covered. The people you met, particularly the bit about the refugees, that sounds really interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, so the one you mentioned in Berlin, it's an art school for children, very accessible, very cheap. So people during the holidays they can come and take part in the workshops. So I would say I'm kind of more or less more specialized in young people. I've been working a lot with young people. So when I went to travel, I had kind of like two missions. My mission was I wanted to improve my Arabic, and my mission was always also to be able to share what I can do with other people. Like, yeah, we all know that this world is a mess, and what I kind of decided for me is what I can give is some, yeah, some love if you want, you know, like some to share some of my creative energy with people. So I tried to find places during my travel where I could give workshops. And in Cairo, I had a friend who introduced me to this learning center, which is a school for refugees, and it's mostly refugees from African countries. So there were people from Somalia, and
Are they presumably in Somalia? That's still a war-torn. I mean, it's probably the most vulnerable African country for the climate change, I think, isn't it? I read recently, and also there's a huge Islamic upsurgence, quite an aggressive, quite an aggressive militant wing. You know, a lot of people have died. I mean, it's been child soldiers. I mean, it's a country which is just on the edge, I think. So you must have met some really sort of vulnerable and, you know, hurt youngsters.
Well, you have to imagine that it was what I was expecting, and it was totally not like this. It was very cool young people, super awake. I had the most beautiful time with them. I was really excited in the way that I thought, okay, how is it going to be with them? Will they be able to participate in what I will offer? Because this is always, if I give a workshop, is it the it's about creating an offer that fits, you know, like this is my job to find something that can do and that is fun for them and interesting. And so I came there for the plan printing thing, and they were just so easy. Like, I just explained it once, and then they were just doing their job, and they were doing very great things. They were perfectly fluent in English.
So sorry, let me take you back. You just said plant printing. Okay, so
Yeah.
tell me and listeners what you mean.
Well, it's actually about just finding some pieces of plants, like leaves and flowers, and then you squeeze it between two papers. It's good to have like big pa like thick papers, like acrylic paper, and you can squeeze it even with, for example, a heavy object like a bottle, so you can get all out all the juice. And then you open the two papers, and then you will have an imprint of the plant juice. And then I'm going to draw on that. So I actually create the structure of the plant, and then I would propose to say, okay, what do you see in there? How can we maybe deepen the red or the green? And this is what I did with them. So, and it was just wonderful what they did. And I didn't even have to explain it a lot. I was just like giving them their stuff, and we went out, had a look at the plants, because this is also a p part of this plant printing. Is like, first of all, get aware of the shape you have in your surrounding, you know, like what does the leaf look like, what color does it have, and how can I use it for the structure I want to create. So this is what we did, and then as it was just so nice with them, I came back for another workshop and did t-shirt printing. So you basically create like a stencil, and then you have a color for fabric, and you paint on your stencil. And this was also very successful because they came up with very nice ideas. And at the end, because I had to leave Cairo then, I left all the stuff there, and I said, like, you can just go on doing your t-shirts. Because then there was also, for example, two guys who were more like in, I think they were in like hip hop, so they had their own logo, and they put their own like rapper names on their t-shirts. So it was just very useful for them also.
I'm whenever I talk to really creative people, my mind gets blown, and so many things start, other rabbit holes start appearing in my head. And while you were talking, I just clicked onto your, I don't know what you call it on Instagram, it might be called Reels or Stories or something, but on plant, you have a section called Plant Prints. And as you were talking about, oh, it's about going into the what, into the wild and into the world and seeing the plants and looking at the colors. You show that, don't you, on your little reel here? It's really it's it. So there's some red plants. I don't know what they are, leaves, and then you show them on the piece of art paper, on a piece of watercolor paper or something, and you're rolling them flat with this roller, and producing just such a beautiful image. And I was immediately thinking how that could be used in combination with pinhole images. And I've been playing with liquid photographic emulsion. I don't know if you've ever used it, where you brush it onto, you warm it up. You buy it in a bottle and you warm it up and brush it onto photographic, onto watercolor paper. And then I've just been projecting an image onto it, you know, and you get a very imperfect image on the watercolor paper, which I really like. But you could easily combine that then with some plant prints, couldn't you? That, to to
That's a very good idea. But you say it's imperfect, the picture, because you cannot have the perfect layer, you mean? Like you have to.
well it when I say imperfect, I mean it's when you make a photographic print on say, Ilford paper, you know, you get you can end up with, you know, beautiful tones, nice whites, nice blacks, and it looks, you know, like a photograph. But when you take a brush and you in particular a brush and you're brushing it onto a stippled surface under a red safe light, you know, sometimes it's not covered in all the same layers of density, the edges can be broken up, and so the resulting image, you can see the brush marks, you can see bits where the emulsion hasn't quite been brushed into the paper properly, and so the image takes on a slightly imperfect look. Which
Oh, I love that idea.
which I
I would
really,
love to try.
yeah. Well, there you go. So, but then you could combine it with your plant printing, I think, and that would, I think that could work really well.
Yeah, it's a wonderful idea. I'm gonna write that down on my to-do list, creative to-do list.
Yeah, there's, I mean, in in Berlin, you've got Foto Impex. Is that that's right, isn't it?
Yeah.
Or, and you can probably go in there and get a bottle of Photo Speed
Yeah.
liquid emulsion for about 40 euros, I think. And then in the dark space under a red light, you can just scoop some of this. It's like a it's almost like a it's set. It's not runny. So you have to take some of it out with a plastic spoon. Don't use metal. And put it in a bowl and with water under hot water underneath, and then it within a few minutes it goes into liquid form, and then you can just brush it onto paper, and then you have to wait for it to dry, and obviously don't shine light on it. Put it in a box or cover it with a black cloth or something, and then you can just use it as a photosensitive base for projecting images onto, or making photograms, I suppose, as well in the dark room, you know.
Yeah,
And or and or
photographs.
and or plant printing.
Yeah, you see, like, yeah, you're giving me good ideas. But it's that's the nice thing about the landslide photography, you know? I mean, it's just endless, and you can just come from one thing to the other, and then yeah, mixing up things. This is actually my specialty, I think. I love to mix it all, like whatever it's useful, let's use it.
So talk about into, so as this is the lensless podcast, and everything we've spoken about so far hasn't involved a lens, but we're primarily focused talking about pinhole photography. So that's generally cameras homemade or bought often these days with a tiny little pinhole in, which, you know, I don't need to explain this to you, of course, but for new folks who just happen to stumble upon this weird podcast, it's making images onto sensitive, normally film, could be paper material, with light just coming through a pinhole. So, when Salim, when did you discover in your biography, in your timeline, when did you discover pinhole photography?
Well, this is the love story. It began in 2016. So, to make it short, like after the bar, I was running the bar for 3 years, and then I was kind of like, I was tired. I wanted to have a normal life again. So, I decided to start to study when I was 24. And I started a bachelor in media studies.
That's in
And
this one is it, so we're in Potsdam now, is that right?
exactly, yeah.
University of Potsdam.
Exactly, yeah. That's near to Berlin. So I was living in Berlin and going to Potsdam every day. And so I was doing an Erasmus year in Madrid. And I was, of course, in the University of Communication. But when you do Erasmus, you can also sign up for arts classes or like classes which are not in your subject. And I was all the time at the art school then. And I signed up for the analog photography class with a wonderful professor who's called Rafa Torbat. He was really like, I still remember him so much. He was such a good professor. And to introduce us to analog photography, he asked us to build a pinhole camera. And at that time, my Spanish was well, but not perfect. So he was explaining how to build this object, and it was very accurate. And he was always like pointing on, you have to do it like perfectly, like how I explain it to you, and not differently. So it was a homework. I went home and I got the box and I did what he told me to do. Not still understanding what I was doing. And I remember also, this is something that is following me. The box was a paper box. You know, if you buy printing paper, it comes in packages. And these packages come in a box, like it's five packages in one box, and it has a lid. So it's just perfect for a pinhole camera. And yeah, so I went back to the university with the box prepared, and I think then he gave me a piece of metal to make the pinhole, and I took my first picture of a pi with a pinhole camera, and I was just
So,
blown.
was he very much telling you that the pinhole had to be a certain size, or and did he how was he telling you to make the pinhole?
Well, he had a formula to calculate which size the needle should have. So it
Okay.
had to be, in my case, it had to be an 11. So I already also had to find out how to find a needle in size 11, because usually if you buy a needle, it's just a
Just the
needle.
needle.
Yeah, no one knows the number it has. But I found the number 11, and yeah, so my pinhole camera was really perfect. And I still have it today. I still use it. And this is also, I mean, this is also important maybe about pinhole photography. If it's working from the first day on, it's just magical. If it's not working, you could maybe lose the feeling of it's interesting. But for me, it worked well. And yeah, I stick to it. So,
Did
of course,
he using photographic paper, presumably, were you? Yeah, yeah.
yeah, I was using photographic paper. And yeah, of course, then Rafa was asking us to buy a real camera, and then yeah, introduced us to shooting on film, developing film, but I was not interested in that at all anymore. I really stick to the pinhole photography, and I built cameras in different sizes, and at that time I was traveling because my boyfriend was living in France. And so I was a lot, yeah, on the way, and so I had tiny cameras because I didn't have a black bag to change the paper. So I built very tiny cameras so I could have more than one. And so, for example, I went to Paris to shoot the Eiffel Tower, so I had a tiny box, and I had to wait one week to develop the picture then in Madrid. And yeah, these moments where, yeah, things are just working, you know. You come back from Paris after 1 week, and then you develop this tiny little paper, and the Eiffel Tower is there. It's just.
So it's like instead of having a 36 exposure roll on a camera, you'd have 36 exposures. Okay, maybe not 36, but you'd have a number of. I mean, it could be anything, couldn't it? Did you use a lot of people use like either photographic film canisters, or they might use small metal mint, for sweets, candy, mint containers. What sort of small, what were you using? Cardboard boxes or
Yeah, yeah.
matchboxes, even some people use?
Yeah, true. No, it was not as small as that.
Okay.
It was maybe 4 by 4 centimeters, 5 by 5.
Okay. Yeah.
It
So
was little
reasonable size.
boxes that I bought, yeah. So usually I was traveling with 3 or 4 cameras. So I had 3 or 4 shots, yeah.
So that in itself makes you consider, I guess, where you go, because you've only got four images. So it's like, a bit like large format photography or any kind of analog film photography, which is getting really expensive. You're considering where you're going to be placing these things.
Yeah, totally. And it was keeping my mind busy, you know. For example, with the Eiffel Tower, it was really a moment where the light was not clear. I arrived in Paris quite late. Like, I had a delay of 2 hours, I think. And yeah, the sun was already going down, so I was not sure. Well, it's not sunny anymore, but it's not dark. So what's going to be the time? And I didn't have anything. I'm not measuring the light. I'm just doing it by feeling, and it kept my mind. I mean, I was then deciding to go for 4 minutes, and I remember that it was keeping my mind busy for the whole stay in Paris, that I was thinking, was it the right time? Was it the right time?
I wouldn't know where to begin at that, because you're using paper with a very slow speed, aren't you? And then
Yeah.
but I suppose, did it help that you were familiar with that pinhole, that design of pinhole camera? So did you have a bit of a intrinsic feel for how long to leave it, and that was like you're an educated and informed guess, as opposed to just, I've no idea, I'll just do 4 minutes.
Yeah, no, it was, of course, I was knowing my cameras then after a
Yeah.
certain time, yeah. But still, it doesn't mean that it always works. There's also sometimes you just don't know why, you know. But yeah, you have to know your camera. Yeah.
And you were going back to your where you were living. Did you say Madrid and developing? Was that in your flat, apartment, house?
I was developing in my bathroom too, but
Okay.
I had access to the university's
Oh, right.
bathroom
Yes.
too. Yeah,
Yep.
so that was really like the glorious time because that was a very good dark room, and we kind of had access whenever we wanted. So
So did your professor encourage this degree of experimentation that you clearly, were showing a bent for?
yeah, totally. Yeah, he was very happy about my work. And I mean, you're always a little bit special if you're an Erasmus because you're like the one from coming abroad. And then I was on top, I was doing these weird things with my camera. So I was really like the alien. But no, he was, he was helping me a lot and he
And
was always interested to see what I did.
did he did you have, w w so you mentioned earlier, you talk about things having a place and maybe a purpose. I may be paraphrasing you a bit. What was we w Did you have a clear idea at that point about your the place that these images were going to be in your life, in other people's lives? Did conversations with the professor help to d develop those ideas?
Well, what came up once I managed to use these cameras was because at that time I was also swimming a lot in a philosophical universe because my studies were really philosophical, also about asking what is a media and how does the media change the society. So at that time, what came with the pinhole discovery was also my questioning on what is photography actually, because
Okay.
it was 2016 and it was the time where selfies came up, people were starting to have smartphones, and I was refusing at that time still to have a smartphone because I was scared to get observed by it. And so I was wondering a lot at that time and trying to find out in a philosophical way, what does it mean that we are producing pictures all the time, sharing them and consuming them, and how does it shape ourselves? Because there was also this whole discussion of the world of selfies and everyone is getting selfish. And, I think that was in 2014. So I was very interested in that because it's a very negative approach to what media will do with our society, you know? So what I then did was I did a Instagram page and I started to take Instagram pictures with my pinhole camera. So I was shooting my lunch, I was doing selfies. I had a camera with a selfie stick. I was trying to reproduce these typical Instagram images with my pinhole camera to kind of like show how absurd it is to, I mean, it just doesn't make sense to make a whole installation to take a picture of your brownies. Like it was just so much effort to do to
But it looks
say.
so it looks so good with a pinhole camera, doesn't it? I've done when I was in Berlin, I took my 3D printed, not homemade, camera with me with some Ektar, and I just photographed all the food and put it on Instagram, but with a pinhole camera, just like you're talking about. And it's just and suddenly the images take on some other meaning in a way,
Yeah, of
there's a
course.
there yeah. And I'd never really thought about it before, because I just thought it was a really interesting thing to do.
It's good that we're talking about it because this is what I said. It's also a little bit a negative approach, like it has a negative perspective on what is Instagram. And I would maybe not do it like this anymore today because I don't think it's good to be judging
Mental,
things.
yeah,
Yeah,
I
yeah.
know.
So anyway, Instagram is what is it is. But for me, it was kind of also an approach to what are people doing while they're taking pictures of their food? So reproducing that is also understanding it, and then reproducing it with a pinhole camera is giving it another touch. But of course, the pictures were not ugly. Of course, but But it was a critical approach, you know, and studying is also, I mean, if you're in this universe of studying and trying to find out what it means to be in the world and why humans are humans, then yeah, this is the approach maybe you have to things, very scientific. And but yeah, it brought me also to the pinhole selfies, which I really like. But this is the place I found for what I was doing, this critique on Instagram, and yeah, giving me a way to think about photography and what it is and what it means today.
So after you'd finished your year, I think, in Madrid, you then went back to carry on your BA in Potsdam.
Yes, I went back to Potsdam, but then I left again to Buenos Aires.
Oh, did you? Okay.
Yeah, I was working on a film festival there,
Right.
and I
Sorry,
had
was this all part of you're doing this between 2014 and 21, University of Potsdam, but you seem to be really not there a lot. You know, you spent a year in Madrid and then you went off to Buenos Aires because you clearly got itchy feet. But was all this part of the university, the Bachelor of Arts? Was it sort of part of it, or was it something you did, you know, as an aside, which wasn't anything to do with the studying that you were doing?
It was both. Well, the Madrid thing was studying, and
Yep.
Buenos Aires was an internship.
Okay.
So I didn't have to do the internship, but I wanted to.
Yeah, why not?
So, but yeah, so it was part of the studying. But I took a lot of time to finish my studies because I was, yeah, looking to other countries and doing things that I was interested in. But this is also the good thing about studying for me is like it's always too short anyway. Like normally it should have taken 3 years, I think, and I took six. But yeah, there's so much to discover, you know. It was not enough time for me to do it just in 3 years.
So
So
what you discovered this love of pinhole photography and started thinking about the way image works in social media, and how you could use your pinhole camera to comment on that. When you then went back and off to Buenos Aires, did you still have that sort of idea and project in your head, or what did you do in Buenos Aires that perhaps took you in other directions?
yeah, in Buenos Aires, it was still this theme because, well, then in Buenos Aires, I decided to have my first smartphone because I was thinking, okay, it's a huge city and I will need a mobile internet. But I was still afraid of being absorbed by it. So I arrived in Buenos Aires and, of course, I wanted to take pictures of everything and share it with my friends. It was very exciting for me.
Think of all the food photographs you could do, you know,
Of course, food and beer and landscapes, cities. And so I decided very at the beginning of my stay, I decided to calm down with the need of capturing everything I was seeing and to build two pinhole cameras at the end of my stay. And then to go back to the places where, yeah, that would remind me on my stay in Buenos Aires and capture them with my pinhole camera. So that calmed me down for the next 3 months because I was like, it's gonna happen at the end, you know, don't worry.
Yeah, and so you're using the time to focus on the experience, and then
Yeah.
at the end of that time, you can look back on the experience
Yeah.
and say, well, what was it that really impacted me or struck me about this place, and how am I now going? Let's go back to those places that had the most impact on me.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So that was a very nice experience also because I had 1 week left in Buenos Aires. I was not working anymore and I found a little photo lab where I could develop my pictures and it was a very nice guy. So that was already part of the experience, which was very nice. And I built two cameras and again made of these paper boxes because you find them in every copy shop. It's actually my format now. And I built two of the cameras, and as they're quite big, it was sometimes, like, yeah, difficult to travel with them in the metro because in Buenos Aires it can be so busy during certain times, you know. And then I got into, yeah, conversations with people. They were like, "What are you carrying there?" Yeah, it's a camera, you know, these kind of conversations, you know, when you do pinhole photography. And yeah, I was realizing this idea, and I got some really nice pictures. Some were really frustrating too because they were underexposed or overexposed, and I had spent 2, 3 hours to make it. But yeah, I have these pictures now, and they are with me. And they, for example, don't really have a place. They're just, yeah, part of my, yeah, creative stock. I never showed them anywhere. It's just there. I needed to realize it.
But they're forming part of who you are and who you were developing into and what you wanted to say really with your art.
Can you say again?
They were, you may not have shared them, but hello, you're back.
Yes.
I think it was me. I think I pressed something and suddenly it came up on the screen to say, "You've done recording." I said, "I haven't done recording." In fact,
Oh,
there's so much more. Whilst we were away there, I don't know what the edit's going to be. I don't think it is going to be an edit. It's just going to be a jump because I'm not very good at editing.
no.
Whilst I was trying to get you back, I was thinking we're going to have to do part two to this, I think. So I think what we'll do is we'll carry on just finishing off your sort of biography, and then if you're up for it, Celine, in a few weeks, whenever's convenient, we'll come back and spend another hour, but talking about some of your images. I mean, I've already just been looking at a pinhole camera with acetate sheets inside, you know.
Yeah.
There's far too many things here to do justice in trying to fit into our sort of normal hour slot. And I want to keep it hour-ish long, you know.
Yeah, I can understand that. Otherwise,
So,
it's getting long, no?
yes, it does. I mean, I
Yeah.
take part in another podcast called the Large Format Photography Podcast. And to be honest, you know, you need a wake-up pill halfway through to keep going because it's like it can be over 2 hours.
Yeah.
So we'll try and keep to that format, but I was just so loving the way the conversation was going, and we haven't really got on to, you know, we touched on some of the plant photography, but there's so much more I want to talk to you about. So if it's okay, we will come back. We're not finished yet, but we'll come back and focus more on the images, the workflow, and some of the things you're doing at the moment with different media. Is that okay?
Yeah, I would love to, of course. Yes.
Brilliant. Okay, that's fantastic. So I think the clumsy question I was trying to ask you were talking about coming to the end of your Buenos Aires trip and making some pinhole images of things that would remind you of your time there and that you hadn't shared them. And I was trying to sort of suggest, well, all of these things that you've been doing are sort of building you, informing you as a person, as an artist, and informing the direction that you're likely to take. So nothing's ever wasted, whether it's shared or not.
Yeah, of course. And this is, I think, a very important thing that you say because I think we're living in a world which is built on efficiency and everything has to have a sense, and art doesn't work like this, you know. You also have to, yeah, make decisions and see what comes out. And sometimes you make decisions and you just see the sense of it 10 years later. And yeah, everything that you do is going to come back to you in a certain way. So yeah, it's completely true what you're saying.
So, at the University of Potsdam, over this extended 3-year, 6-year degree, Bachelor of Arts, European Media Studies. So, yeah, I can see how when you're in Buenos Aires, you were working in, did you say filmmaking?
Film festival, yeah.
Film festival.
Yeah.
Okay. So that sounds fascinating. What were you doing? In your time there.
I was working for a film platform and uploading the films that were shown on the festival.
Okay.
So that was actually very interesting because I was in contact with all the film directors from different countries. And it was my first, like, this kind of digital job where I was getting to know people, but just in a digital form. But it was very interesting because some of them were so nice that I felt like, oh, I would love to meet you one day. So, but the exciting part of this work was like we were preparing the festival, and then once it started, it was like 2 weeks of festival. We were just in the cinema all the time, and I mean, I'm a festival person. I love this dense time where you meet people who are interested in the same stuff as you, and you're just completely in your world and zone of comfort, you know? So, yeah, it's so intense.
So it's visual media, it's expression, it's ideas and thought. Were they very art housey type films that were being shown?
Not just no, you also had classical Argentinian films. No, it was very mixed.
So clearly this then is once again, it's informing you as a person, it's broadening your world, it's making connections. Were they the key sort of takeaways from that time in Buenos Aires?
Yeah, completely. And I mean, whenever and wherever I'm traveling, for me, it's always the people I get to know and the relationships I get. So, yeah, I came back from Buenos Aires full of love, you know, as in, it was a very good experience. Yeah, I'll
So
never
what
forget my
no
time.
it sounds is it somewhere that you'll revisit, do you think? Go back to?
Yes, I hope so. I still have some contacts with friends over there. And one of the girls I met there came to Berlin to visit me too, Bernadita, and I met her on the festival, and still we chat sometime.
So on one of my dear friends who I've not met yet, but she lives on the west coast of America on a little island outside of Portland, that sort of area. And she's Argentinian. Her name is Lorraine Healy, and she fled Buenos Aires during the Pinochet years. And she's a photographer and a poet. And she's been on this show. So if you, I can't, because I wasn't expecting to talk about her. Lorraine Healy, look back into the list of shows. And she's published a couple of books about her memories as a child of leaving Argentina, and the suspicion and issues around, the disappeared and all the political troubles that were going on at the time. And she's on Instagram as well. So Lorraine Healy, you should, if you're not already in contact with her, you should reach out. She's another lovely, creative person, but poetry and pinhole photography are her things.
Okay, yeah, great.
L
Lorraine
Lorraine
Healy.
Healy, Healey, I think. So, how many years did you have to go when you came back from Buenos Aires to in your European Media Studies course? Were you coming to the end of it, or?
No. No. Well, what happened then? Well, after Buenos Aires, I had some stuff to do in Berlin. Things happened in my life, and I needed to find a new job. I had to move. Yeah, I had to move to another place. So, I was a little bit absorbed by these real life things. Well, then, yeah, I was going on studying. I was discovering artists. I was really into Francesca Woodman.
So in Liv I've spoken about this before. In Liverpool a few years ago at the Tate, there was an exhibition of her and the other a painter, Egon Schiele. I don't know if I've probably said that right, but both of them, and they were exhibiting together. Obviously, they both died young. Well, anyway, and all very tragic. But they both had the idea of no. They were both trying to talk about self-imagery and the way we see each other and people and bodies and of course, Francesca Woodman is just a very creative but tragic sort of figure in many ways, and I think he was too, you know. But the two exhibitions together, into it, with their work mixed up, it was just fascinating, you know?
Yeah, sounds great. Yeah, of course.
Yeah, yeah, so you just, I mean, you did, both, did you discover, yeah, Francesca Woodman for the first time then at that sort of point?
Yeah. I discovered for the first time, and I was very fascinated by her work.
Yeah.
So I was writing something about her for my bachelor, not for my bachelor, but for the university, and so I was more in the theoretical things at that.
But that her images now, you could sort of throw those into the same melting pot as the Instagram, you know, the ideas around Instagram culture and selfies, self image, how artificial it is, what we want to project to the world, our fears and our hopes. All of that is tied in with what, you know, when people look at Francesca Woodman's work now, and particularly in light of her, you know, taking her own life at a fairly young age.
Yeah, you're totally right. Of course, yeah. I mean, at the end, it's always a little bit the same questions, like, how do we look at ourselves? How do the society also form the perspective we have on bodies? And how do we create identities, and which identities are the right ones and the wrong ones? This is also how do we judge identities? And I think that's something I would always be interested in. And maybe it's also a question of age, you know, like that was like an end of my 20s. So this is still the time where you're asking yourself, who am I? What do I look like? And where do I go? And Francesca Woodman did this search in a visual way that was touching me a lot. And it's also kind of dark and magical. So you can, for me, while knowing her story also, you could see there's also a tragic in her work. But I think what is also fascinating for me in that work is that she's really constantly searching, you know, she's not giving up. She's been doing so many photographies, and you see there's really this will and desire of understanding and going further. And this is something that is fascinating me, I think.
Okay. So you came eventually to the end of your European media studies, and we're nearly up to date, aren't we? Because it was 2021, and you'd have gone through the COVID period as well, presumably. Yeah. How did that affect your studies? Because it wasn't an easy time for students anywhere in the world, was it?
Yeah, well, I didn't have a lot of classes left anymore at that time, so I didn't have a lot of online classes. But my bachelor thesis to end my studies, to finish my studies, was to develop a pinhole workshop for an arts class or for an art school for young people. So it affected my studies in the way that I couldn't give the workshop, of course, because at that time it was, yeah, you cannot put 5 people into a dark room. Don't even think about it. So I had to do all my stuff theoretically. I was designing the idea of how the workshop would work and what's also the educational benefits about using pinhole photography with young people, and how I would like to develop the offer I'm making for them, how to use it and how I would introduce it. And then I had to wait until I could give the workshop at the school and see if what I imagined would happen and work. But actually I was very, very happy once that was done, you know, like 6 years of studies was enough. Yeah.
You could have almost trained to be a doctor in that time, couldn't you?
Yeah.
And probably earning a lot more money.
Of course.
But that would have, all of this then informs the journey that you went on when you decided to travel around to Cairo and Lebanon and places.
Yeah, Yeah, this since I discovered pinhole photography or like, these kind of creative works, I always have the feeling of I want to share it. Like, yeah.
Just before we finish part one, and we'll come back to part two in a while and look more at the types of areas of work that you're working in, focus more on the process and some of the techniques maybe. You mentioned earlier, I think it probably before we started, about what the influence your father, who's very French, has on you, and he's in this world as well, in the art world.
Yeah, he is well, he's interested in photography too. And he's also someone who's been working with yeah, he was doing creative work with people. And yeah, since he's retired and he's living in this little house in South France, he's doing anthotypes. And he's been explaining me how he's producing different kind of juices, like with beetroot and orange juice and pepper. So yeah, there is a connection. So sometimes I just went to see him some weeks ago, and then we're coming with all our papers because I'm working with a lot of cyanotype at the moment, and we're
Brilliant.
showing each other like, ah, yeah, I tried with this juice and how it, and yeah, it's very inspiring also to have my father talking to me about his
That's really
plant
lovely.
juice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and of course he's got sunshine, so
Yeah.
he's
More
got
than
lot lot
growing.
lots of what you need for many of these things.
Yeah, and he has a garden.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we'll dive into anthotypes a little bit in part two, along with your work with cyanotypes. Your different pinhole cameras you're using, that one with the perspex, and I know you're using pinhole cameras with different things that aren't pinholes, crosses and triangles and various things. So, Celine, look, if people want to see your work, is it, as I mentioned earlier, Instagram, obscura underscore Berlin?
Yeah, that's it. I don't have a website until now, yeah.
You're not on the dreaded Twitters or I can recommend Blue Sky Media. Blue Sky is
Yeah,
like
I
Blue
never
Sky is
heard
like
about it.
well t take a look. If you, at the moment
Yeah.
it's there's a whole load of creative folks out there and a lot of film photographers, and it's like it's very much the same as Twitter used to be.
Yeah. Blue sky. I'm gonna write that down.
Yeah, when you go onto it, you'll find that you'll need an invite code. This is a temporary thing, but many of us who are over there, we get given invite codes. So, if you want to dip your toe into the world of Blue Sky Media, then reach out to me and I'll dig out an invite code from somebody so you can
Okay.
join. But
Okay, great. Thank you.
it's been a very positive experience joining Blue Sky, and I shall be winding up my Twitter account towards the end of the year. With some mixed feelings, but anyway, there we are. So obscura underscore Berlin. Celine, it's been wonderful, and we'll talk about dates for part two, if that's all right.
Okay, yeah, great. I had a very good time. Thank you so
No,
much.
it's been lovely. Sorry for the slight technical hitch halfway through, or not really halfway through, towards the end, folks. So till next time, Celine, take care and thank you
Yeah,
so much.
you too. Have a good
Okay.
day. Bye
Yeah,
bye.
bye-bye, everybody. Bye.